Please silence all electronic devices.
I think we all agree that we don't want non-citizens, non-U.S. citizens voting in our elections, but but that's not really a problem in our state.
Members, it appears we have concluded our business unless we can find another non-controversial bill to add to the calendar today.
As a member of this chamber, duly elected by the voters of North Carolina, I will reserve the right to answer a question when I get good and doggone ready.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Fourth Estate Studio in downtown Raleigh, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for clicking play. It's time to review the week in North Carolina politics. Here for the discussion are Becky Gray with the conservative John Locke Foundation and Rob Schofield from the progressive NC Policy Watch. Hey there.
Hey, guys. Hey.
More turmoil in the UNC system, this time at ECU. The interim chancellor in Greenville, Dan Gerlach, found himself in hot water after videos emerged of him out at local bars, drinking with young folks. He was suspended while a review takes place. The East Carolina University campus has in large part rallied to his defense, taking to Twitter, circulating a petition that got thousands and thousands of signatures. Gerlach said in interviews this week that he believes this was a setup. Plenty of other people say that this is clearly poor judgment. What do each of you make of this?
Well, full disclosure, Dan and I worked together many years ago. 20 years ago, he worked at the Budget and Tax Center, which is a project of the North Carolina Justice Center, which I helped start 25 years ago. I haven't talked to Dan much, frankly, since he left us a couple of decades ago. But my impression of it, and I think he has admitted on the radio in Greenville, is that this was incredibly poor judgment on his part and was a terrible mistake to be out with young people and drinking in a bar. And, you know, I just think it's really depressing. I think it's emblematic, though. There was a fine article that Joe Killian wrote for NC Policy Watch this week in which he pointed out that this is just sort of one of a long list of items that there's been chaos at the UNC system. You referred to it, sort of this turmoil in leadership at the UNC system over the last few years. You know, Gerlach's only in place in that job because there was a firing of the previous chancellor under mysterious circumstances in which the then president of the board of UNC and the chairman of the board of UNC and the president of the system refused to say why Cecil Staton was removed. Now the chair of the board, Harry Smith, who helped make that happen, has leaving, as is Bill Roper, who is the president of the system on an interim basis. There's just a lot of chaos in the university system, and it cries out for some sort of stability to be brought, for some sort of person who's a consensus builder, who has the support of both sides of the political aisle to come in and bring some peace and some balance, guidance, yeah, all those things to the system at UNC.
What was the word you were thinking? Did it come to you or no?
No.
Okay. All right. You'll think of it at some point.
Well, Jeff, to get back to your question about this situation with Dan Gerlach, full disclosure as well, I've known Dan for probably 20 years and have worked with him professionally in a variety of ways. He was the state budget director, advisor to Governor Mike Easley. He was the leader of the Golden Leaf Foundation and just, you know, have known him professionally for a number of years. Think the world of him. He's one of the finest people that I know. He has said that he used poor judgment, you know, and he's been very forthright about this. I agree with Dan. I think he did use poor judgment. Is this a fireable offense? Given the set of circumstances, and he came in as an interim chancellor into a situation where Dan's expertise and clearly his highest skill is budgets and budgetary issues. He's gone in and already has made some significant changes at ECU for the better. Also, one of his goals has been to be out, to get acquainted, to know the students, to be accessible, and he's done that from the very first day that he was there. Is this a step too far? Probably so. Is it a fireable offense? I don't think so. And what we're hearing from the ECU community, the majority, I mean, I don't know. I mean, there are people on the other side of this as well who are calling for his record. There are a lot of people who are supportive of him, have said this is exactly what they need. And this is from the faculty, from students, from parents, from members of the Pirate Nation community. So there's tremendous support for him.
But I mean, if you're looking for someone to lead your system, to be the symbol of your university, you know, it. I can see why some people would think that's just not what we need. We can't have that kind of behavior.
Conveniently, I don't believe either of you answered the question. Do you believe this is a setup? Do you believe someone either purposely went after him here, or that somebody saw an opportunity and is going after him for political gain?
I'm not even sure what that means. The man was in public. He was doing. There's no debate about what he was engaged in. I don't see how it could possibly be. Fact that somebody went to the trouble of circulating the information, I guess you could call it that. But he's a man in public responsible for his own behavior.
Yeah, define setup. I mean, nobody made him, at the end of a very busy day, go out and have a couple beers and make that decision and, meet up with, I think, some law enforcement officers and those kind of things. I mean, the photographs are real. Nobody has said they've been fake. The only thing, and I think where that comes from, is there was a package of those photographs with videos that were sent to media outlets immediately. Was that a setup? Was that a ploy? Was that an attack on Dan Gerlach? I mean, I don't know. I don't know that we know that.
I think in today's world of social media, you're out in public. You're doing stuff like that. It's public. I mean, there's just no – it doesn't matter whether it's – packaged neatly, it's going to be public, and there's no way to keep it from being such.
One observation from my perspective, just in line with public officials or people in the public eye, I was just surprised that he didn't have a handler, an assistant, someone with him. And maybe that's unrealistic to think that someone's always going to have someone by their side, but to be out in town in the school where you are chancellor, having a drink or having too many drinks with undergraduates, it would seem as though someone should have been there with him. Clearly.
But that also speaks to Dan's effort to be accessible and be, a real guy and be somebody who can sit and talk to students. And, again, I mean, he's admitted, this was probably poor judgment. But it's very typical of Dan Gerlach not to have a handler or not to be scripted.
Meanwhile, a controversial proposal to give Duke Energy more autonomy over rate increases reemerged and then quickly moved forward at the legislature on Wednesday. It would allow Duke to increase rates 3 years in advance rather than having to go before the Utility Commission every time that it wants to increase prices. Listeners may remember that this bill had previously been tabled, but it is back. Stripped out of the measure is a proposed study that would have slowed the process down to really understand how this all would have played out, unintended consequences, so on and so forth. Becky, is this a special interest at work and a monopoly, I would add, by the way, or a truly necessary change?
I think it's a truly necessary change. And the reason why Duke is proposing and asking for this alternative rate authorization process that we have, and it is very different than what we've had before, but it is to modernize, build, and update the grid. Think of it in terms of like an infrastructure project, and we're seeing this with water and sewer systems across North Carolina. We're very outdated systems that were built 50 years ago need to be updated in order to provide that and the stability of a water and sewer system. This is kind of the same thing with our electric system. And so that's what's behind this. This is why they're asking for it. As we have seen more and more renewable energy go onto the grid, it becomes quickly apparent that that grid needs to be updated in order to handle that. Also, just think of the way that commercial customers, manufacturing, have changed. Residential, where the residential customers are and the demand on the grid. As we increase in population, those kind of demands increase as well, and we have to be prepared for it. Now, it's a very different way of doing this rate changes, updates, the flow of the rates with Duke Energy. And so that's what this is all about. I mean, the problem we're trying to solve is how do we ensure that the infrastructure for electricity is up to date and able to handle all the renewable energy and the changes that we've seen over the last 10, 15 years?
I don't disagree at all that we need updates to the grid. There is a global environmental crisis that we are going to be feeling the effects of for the next several decades. Duke is the largest utility in the world, I guess, one of the biggest, if not the biggest. They clearly have an outsized role in the politics of North Carolina. They clearly have an outsized role in dictating policy at the legislature. They spend millions upon millions of dollars on influencing public opinion, influencing lawmakers with lobbying efforts. They need to be a part of the solution. They are at the center of a global environmental crisis, and they have had to be drag kicking and screaming to do the right thing. They still haven't gotten there. And I worry very much that this is more still about the traditional approach that Duke has had, which is that it puts profits first. It's about shareholders and profits more than it is about the central role they play in the future of our planet.
But, you know, if Duke is, as you say, the largest, I'm not sure that's accurate. They are a large supplier of electricity,
and certainly
the biggest in North Carolina.
No, I think they're the biggest supplier of electricity in the world.
Are they really?
They really are.
Huge responsibility then. I mean, you know, we all want to be able to walk into a room and turn the lights on. We want to be able to turn our air conditioner on. We want to be able to do those things. It's a huge economic driver. With that comes huge responsibility. And part of it is to be able to provide this infrastructure, this upgrade of the grid in order to accommodate that. So, you know, whether this is the right way to do it or not, I don't know. In this bill, the profits that they have it gets very complicated. But if profits go over a certain amount, it automatically goes to low-income customers. If it goes another threshold, it goes back to the customers. So there are guardrails in there to protect against just what Rob has alluded to, that they're just out for profits.
Well, here's one thing you know for sure. The General Assembly members don't completely understand this. And the idea of studying it more thoroughly before altering the system to adopt this system where they get the set rates for many years makes complete sense, and I think it's a mistake to move away from having done that. And it's a silly time. We ought not even to be in session. Here we are in October. We're 3 months past the end of session. This is something that should have been turned over to a thorough study a few months ago, and we shouldn't be racing it through here in the waning days of this endless 2019
session. You often are a fan of work studies, of taking a step back to
sure.
better understand something.
Right.
Why not in this instance?
Well, I mean, at what point do you say, okay, we've studied it enough, we put the guardrails in.
But have they studied this proposal?
Well, I mean, what is enough? Yes, they certainly have, and they have put guardrails into this bill. Senator Dan Blue spoke on this earlier this week as the bill went through the Senate about the guardrails that are put in place, the oversight and the accountability to experts in this field. I mean, you know, Rob's right. This is a very complicated issue. Many of us don't understand every nuance of it, but that's how it is with a lot of public policy that we deal with in North Carolina. So, you know, at some point you have to say, okay, we've got to move forward with this. In the meantime, again, you've got these could very well lead to a grid crisis if we don't move forward and begin to address these needs. Now, you know, does that mean it has to be done tomorrow? Does it mean that we can't wait another year? I don't know the answer to that. What we do is we look to experts to say, okay, it's now time to move forward with it.
We do know there's a broad consensus amongst consumer and environmental experts and advocates that this is not the correct approach. And at a minimum, there ought to be some sort of stakeholder process where Duke is forced to sit down with some of those parties and work this out rather than ramming it through over their objections.
Well, I mean, they have. I mean, there's been numerous stakeholder meetings
with a tremendous amount of people.
Part of this whole process is to have public comments. But, you know, the governor, I mean, I think it's interesting that the governor has just come out with his climate plan that calls for more and more renewable energy.
Sure.
And, you know, as we move towards that, we got to have some place to plug it in and make it work. So, you know, as we move further and further with an aggressive plan towards more and more renewable energy, we've got to have the grid that's going to put that energy into the pipeline so that it gets to customers and gets to customers.
But consumer environmental advocates ought to be a part of that, not to be that Duke is just calling shots, and this is clearly a Duke Energy drafted and driven bill.
From the parliamentary standpoint of this measure, it is through the Senate. It now goes to the House and then on to the governor. It's unclear if Governor Cooper will veto this or not. He had said he had some problems with the bill, and it seems as though he or his staff have changed the language a little bit with which they're kind of circling the wagons mm-hmm. of this Duke Energy bill and saying that they're going to review it. So it's unclear if he's going to veto it. If he does veto it, it would seem to me that there are not going to be enough people to override a veto, but we're getting way ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. There have been a lot of controversial bills this session that the governor's vetoed, and obviously we haven't had much in the way of overrides. It'd be surprising to see it here.
With the governor's very aggressive move, and just, you know, in the last week or so, we've seen this towards more and more demand mandates for increased renewable energy. I don't know how he vetoes this bill. I mean, you know, you can't say, yeah, we want more of it, but we're not going to pay for it. I mean, it doesn't work.
It doesn't have to come from Duke, does it? I mean, an improved solar infrastructure,
Once it gets on the grid, yeah, it has to.
There is an established system. We have a utilities commission in place. We have a system in place for the utilities commission to approve rate hikes, to approve for how we're going to pay for this structure. And I think there's a real genuine debate as to whether it's necessary to go down this road to make that happen. I think there are plenty of experts who think that the current system or some modified version of that would be perfectly adequate. The issue here is getting Duke to pay its fair share. A lot of this is. I mean, Duke is an enormously profitable corporation that's making billions of dollars in profits. Arguably, more of the money should be coming from their profits than from ratepayers. That's the kind of discussion we need to have and involve consumer advocates and environmental advocates rather than just pushing a bill through that's drafted by Duke in the waning days of the session.
Former Congressman Robin Hayes pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI in federal court. Hayes was the chair of the state GOP party when he got caught up and played a central role in what prosecutors say is a bribery scheme to gain influence over insurance regulations. Hayes may or may not serve prison time. Really will depend on his level of cooperation and the rest of this investigation. We've talked about money in campaigns before, and I'm wondering more from you, Becky, if this whole saga has given you any more of an appetite for campaign finance reform.
What it's given me an appetite is to make sure that we have people of integrity in place in leadership positions. You know, I'm not sure. I don't know what regulation could have prevented this. I mean, Robin Hayes is looking at possible prison time for this. I mean, you know, so I'm not sure that another rule would have made any difference in this.
I believe that contributions to the state party are unlimited. And that is part of the reason why Greg Lindbergh, the billionaire businessman from Durham, has donated, I believe, it's upwards of like $6.5 million.
It's a lot of money.
To candidates, right. To both parties. I mean, he has just sent all kinds of money into the political infrastructure here in North Carolina. Do you believe a law, and I'm just going from the hip here, that would max a donation, just as candidates have maximum allowable donations, what if the party had a maximum allowable donation of $20,000 or $25,000?
I think it's a dangerous road to go down when you start limiting people's ability to participate in the political process. I think we need more accountability. I think we need more transparency. I think we need more openness in that process. I'm not sure that putting restrictions on it and making more – you know, we have a lot of laws in place. Again, this whole Lindbergh case is because of the laws that we have in place. I don't know that – additional laws would have made any difference again.
Well, obviously, I disagree. I think very much that we need much stronger restrictions on how much money individuals can give, how much money they can launder through political parties, launder through these political committees. I mean, this guy Lindbergh has given $2.4 million to groups supporting Dan Forrest, the man who's presumably going to be the Republican nominee for governor next year. I mean, that's astounding. I recognize he's given money to Democrats, too, but my gosh, this is millions of dollars from one individual who's clearly a corrupt individual. We need to take whatever steps we can to minimize the chance of these kinds of people infiltrating and infecting our political process. And I would be very worried if I were anybody close to this scandal, because Robin Hayes is clearly has a real incentive now to cooperate with the prosecutors and tell everything he knows. It's a sordid saga. There could be Democrats involved as well, Republicans. It's a mess, and it bespeaks once again the crying need for campaign finance reform in our state and for a move towards publicly financed campaigns.
And we know via court filings that have emerged in recent weeks that Lindbergh is trying to use a Bob McDonald defense. And McDonald is the former governor of Virginia. He got caught up in a bribery scandal that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and he was acquitted. His a lower court conviction was vacated by the U.S. Supreme Court. And Lindbergh, just to offer his perspective here, his attorneys are asking the court to dismiss this. I don't think that's going to happen, but we'll see. Has asked the court to dismiss this because the U.S. Supreme Court in the McDonald case largely allowed for some level of I won't use the word bribery because it wasn't that, gifts in exchange for access and influence.
And, you know, that quid pro quo is illegal. It has always been illegal. People have gone to prison over that. You know, let's not forget the, you know, former Speaker of the House, Jim Black, spent time in prison, you know, for these kind of activities. It's inexcusable. But we have laws in place to do it, and we need to prosecute to the full extent of the law. And it doesn't surprise me that Greg Lindberg is trying to pull in every trick in the book that he – I mean, he's looking at some serious allocations, and you know, his I'm sure his legal team is very well paid, and they're looking for you know, anything they can get to minimize what looks to be a pretty severe penalty, and it should be.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, those penalties for, you know, for breaking the law should be severe.
Yeah, I agree. I don't doubt that he's trying to figure out a way to worm out of it, but I mean, the optics here are terrible, and it's hard to conceive how he does get out of it, but I'm sure if you have a lot of money and you pay a lot of high-powered lawyers, you give it a shot.
Finally, briefly, Senator Phil Berger told reporters that they're going home by the end of the month. That happened on Monday. I believe it was Wednesday. Speaker Tim Moore said somewhat playfully that the Senate can go home when the House says so. Are we out of here by Halloween?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I don't see how. I mean, I guess they could just decide to give up and say, we're not going to negotiate a budget with the governor. We're going to pass a few more of these mini budgets and go home. I mean, I think it's a real abrogation of their duty and responsibility. They should have sat down with the governor months ago and figured this out. But obviously, we're not finding any common ground. There's been no real effort at negotiations. So maybe it will happen. I do understand that lawmakers are sick of being here, and I think the public's sick of having them in Raleigh.
Who knows? I mean, you know, happy Halloween. Let's all get our costumes out. But there's still some things that the General Assembly needs to address before they adjourn. You know, we don't have a resolution on the Farm Act, which greatly will impact the hemp industry. A lot of people have an interest in that and hope that something is done with that. We talked about the Duke Energy Bill, and, you know, that's going to go over to the House and where that's going to go. They're passing these mini budgets that are taking care of the budgetary needs that there's wide agreement on. So they're taking care of that. And then, of course, because of a 2017 law, we revert back to last year's spending. So all of that is going okay. The one big thing that I think they need to address before they go home, and they need to do it in this session before we move into the next election cycle, is to address redistricting reform. And so there is enough to keep them busy, certainly. And I think Rob and I agree, you know, the more debate and discussion and all that we have on these issues, the better. So there's certainly enough time, but probably Halloween it's time to go home.
Rob might think there might have been enough study on that one, on redistricting reform. He might be ready to send that one forward and done with the conversations. We will see. I have no expectation that they'll be gone by Halloween.
Trick or treat.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, guys.
Becky and Rob can be heard on your radio each Friday at 10 minutes of 5 on WUNC 91.5 FM or at WUNC.org. If you want to catch the 8-minute version of our conversation, for the longer discussion, you can always find it in your podcast feed. As a reminder, we have two podcasts dropping these days. The other one comes earlier in the week. This week, I had a conversation with Dr. Leighton Koo, a professor at George Washington University, who authored a study about the economic and employment benefits of Medicaid expansion. So you can listen to that conversation as well. We'll be back with you next week for whatever is going on in North Carolina politics. For Becky and Rob, I'm Jeff. Take care.